why I talk about the violent backlash to multiracial democracy during Reconstruction, because there are precedents for Donald Trump. He didn't just come out of nowhere. He is an authoritarian leader that benefits from a deeply undemocratic political system. And that's why we need to change the political system itself if we want to prevent more Trumps in the future.
What are the most promising resistance movements to this that you see?
I think the most promising resistance movements right now are at the state level in places like Michigan, where people are using direct democracy to expand rights and to fight a rigged political system, where they're doing things like ending partisan gerrymandering, expanding voting rights, enshrining abortion access. It's very easy to get dismayed at what's happening at the federal level and feel like it's impossible to change it. But you look at Michigan, you look at Wisconsin, a lot of really interesting things are happening at the state level, where the push for minority rule has led to an equally fierce push for majority rule. And the forces that are trying to rig American democracy have led to a broader pro-democracy movement to protect it.
Ari Berman, I want to thank you so much for being with us. I know you'll be at the Brooklyn Public Library speaking with Chris Hayes on Monday night and going around the country with your book. Journalist and author Ari Berman, his new book, Minority Rule, The Right-Wing Attack on the Will of the People and the Fight to Resist It. Voting rights correspondent for Mother Jones Magazine. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Supported community radio.
What does the average KBOO listener think of self-help radio?
This is so hard and complicated.
I have no idea what it is.
What is this old-time music?
I feel so proud of myself.
It seems kind of worthless.
Why does it have to make so much noise?
It sounds very hipster.
That's the worst thing.
Look at how humanity has used their intellect.
Self-help radio, a different theme explored with music and talk every week. Tuesdays, midnight to 3 a.m. on KBOO Portland.
Postmodernism, a reaction against the ideas and values of modernism. Avant-garde, new, unusual, and experimental ideas. KBOO, a community radio station that supports both. Join us in our mission to push the status quo by becoming a member today. Go to kboo.fm/give between now and May 25th to donate and help us reach our $60,000 spring membership drive goal.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. It's time for your KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, students at PSU start a protest encampment for a ceasefire in Gaza, as school administrators say they'll pause the university's relationship with Boeing.
The Multnomah County budget for next year gets pushback from two commissioners.
And in national news, the FCC votes to reinstate net neutrality.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, April 26th, 2024. I'm Ezra.
And I'm Ray Bodwell. This week, students at Portland State University sent a letter to University President Ann Cudd demanding that the school cut ties with Boeing due to their involvement with the war in Gaza. According to a March press conference, Boeing invested over $100,000 in the school itself and more in yearly scholarships. Up until this point, the school hasn't had plans to change anything in its relationship with Boeing. In light of recent pro-Palestinian protests, though, Cudd has said that they're, quote, shifting the approach with Boeing, according to OPB. In a moderated forum scheduled for May, which will include both faculty and staff, the school will open the floor for new ideas and opinions. But Cudd doesn't see the need for students to attend classes remotely in light of the protests. She told OPB, quote, "The university supports free speech for its students and faculty, but would not allow for intimidation or threats to take place." Protesting PSU students, some holding anti-Boeing signs, were removed from the park blocks last night by Portland police officers after setting up an encampment, including several tents. No arrests were reported, and as of this afternoon, the protest encampment has returned to the area in front of the PSU library.
Yesterday, Multnomah County Board Chair Jessica Vega Peterson released the proposed fiscal year budget for 2025 for the county. It is the first budget process that Vega Peterson has overseen from the very beginning, and yesterday the board voted to move the proposal forward to the next step of the process, which is a review by the Tax Supervising and Conservation Committee. This was a largely procedural step in the budget process, but still met with pushback from Commissioner Sharon Mirren and Julie Brim Edwards, who both voted against the resolution. They both wanted more time to review the budget further before taking a vote that, in the language in the language of the resolution, approves the proposal. As Brim Edwards explains, while they have only known about the resolution for a week, the budget proposal itself was released today.
I take my vote very seriously, so if I vote for something, like, I'm usually all in, unless I say it, or if I have a significant concern, I'm not afraid to be a no vote if, you know, I have to be, but I don't know what's in here, and like I say, I'm hopeful by the overview that it includes many, many things, but, like, is there funds for actually standing up the sobering center in here? Like, I don't know that, and so those are the types of things that I'd want to know before I take an official action, which is a thing, which is approving the budget.
The resolution to submit the budget proposal for review passed 3-2, including a yes vote from Commissioner Jesse Beeson, who is filling out the remainder of the term of Sushila Jayapal as she runs for the U.S. House of Representatives. Beeson explained his vote to move forward in the context of the work the public is asking the county to accomplish.
The primary way that the vast majority of our residents interact with us is primarily through the libraries. But for decades and decades, most of the county's work was focused on people that our society just generally doesn't care about or want to see. Old people, disabled people, incarcerated people, poor and black and brown people. And so when the visibility of homelessness and our mental health crisis and substance use crisis spilled so much onto the street that every person in the resident in Multnomah County could not help but pay attention, then the focus on the county became far more intense, I think, than we've ever experienced as a jurisdiction. And so many people are asking questions that they didn't ask for decades because generally, out of sight, out of mind. And so it's revealed so much of what underinvestment for decades looks like and the impatience of the American public in solving intractable issues and wanting them solved very quickly. I get the frustration, and I also recognize that we are here to move forward into a budget process to start to deliberate more intensely on those.
That was County Commissioner Jesse Beeson at yesterday's Multnomah County Board meeting.
Board Chair Jessica Vega Peterson introduced the budget proposal by emphasizing the county's stated priorities and financial constraints.
Continuing to create and resource the critical safety net that supports those who need it most directed the investments in my proposed $3.96 billion FY25 executive budget, which also helps us build the Multnomah County we need most at this moment. There are hard choices and tough trade-offs here. I started this budget process with a $14 million deficit, but I believe it reflects compromises that mirror our values and priorities.
One of the programs that has been fully eliminated in the proposed budget is the Multnomah Idea Lab, part of the Department of Human Services, or DHS, which was founded in 2015 to address the racial wealth gap by, quote, seeking approaches at the intersection of poverty and racism. The projects include the Multnomah's Mother's Trust Project, which provides monthly unconditional cash transfers of $500 each to 100 participants identified as black mothers in need, and then tracks the difference that the money made for them and their families. Other Idea Lab projects on making DHS services and benefits more accessible to eligible county residents, long-term financial assistance for children affected by white supremacy culture, automating the earned income tax credit for eligible households, coordinating immigrant and refugee services, and many other initiatives. According to the budget proposal, the Idea Lab was eliminated in favor of focusing funding on, quote, client-facing programs, end quote, and a total of 8 full-time positions will be cut.
7 people died in Multnomah County Jail last year. Nurses at the jail put some of the blame on their boss, Mike Obiero, the corrections health director in the county. The nurses' union hand-delivered a letter outlining their concerns to the county commissioners on Thursday. In it, they accuse Obiero and the county of, quote, gross mismanagement, supported by the results of a subpar recent National Institute of Corrections evaluation. They question whether Obiero is fully qualified for the position and how much responsibility he holds for the 7 deaths. The letter details a lack of adequate staffing and that nurses have been forced to take mandatory overtime, something other healthcare settings don't require. According to the letter, Obiero spent hours of work time in his office watching sports, he lacked the 7 years required experience, and amidst a short staffing crisis, he left for a month of vacation. Nurses say he's, quote, frequently absent and, quote, unreachable by phone during business hours. The nurses' union says they sent the letter with their concerns because they've been unable to get on the county commissioner's agenda. County Chair Jessica Vega Peterson says the union, quote, needs to follow up so we can understand and address their concerns. This adds to a staffing crisis in which the county blames a lack of qualified candidates, and qualified candidates blame mandatory overtime and low pay in these positions. Nurses at the jail have been leaving their jobs in search of other work in considerable numbers. The mandatory overtime Multnomah County Corrections relies on from their nurses is illegal in most hospital settings.
Portland City Council's newest plan to ban homeless camping on city streets advanced on Wednesday, with Commissioner Rene Gonzalez's amendments rejected by the council. Mayor Ted Wheeler's new plan would ban people from doing certain activities like building fires and blocking sidewalks while camping on public property. Violators would face criminal penalties. People experiencing homelessness would still be allowed to camp on public property, but only if there isn't enough shelter space available. In Multnomah County, that's not a question because current shelter capacity can only hold about a third of those sleeping unsheltered on county streets every night. The ordinance will come up again in 2 weeks when commissioners will vote. If passed, it would ban people from using a propane heater, digging into the ground, starting a fire, or selling bike parts. Wheeler acknowledged that his prior effort at a camping ban had been thwarted by lawsuits, and that this one was likely to get the city sued as well. Commissioner Gonzalez led his own efforts to add amendments to this ordinance, including one sent to the commissioners just hours before the city council meeting. His plan would have increased the criminal penalty for people camping on Portland streets and consolidated further rulemaking authority on homelessness under the office of the mayor, a position he's running for, along with Commissioners Rubio and Mapps. His amendments were voted down.
The Federal Communications Commission voted on Thursday to restore net neutrality rules initially implemented during the Obama administration. The rules are aimed at preventing internet providers like Verizon or Comcast from blocking or degrading the delivery of services from competing platforms such as Netflix and YouTube. The purpose of the regulations is to prevent internet providers from manipulating the quality of consumers' experiences when they use the internet. The FCC seeks to regulate broadband as a utility-like service, like phones or water. Net neutrality rules were rolled back under the Trump administration. Republican lawmakers and FCC commissioners maintained that the rules were an example of unnecessary government involvement. Net neutrality is a contentious partisan issue. The FCC measure passed on Thursday on a 3-2 vote split along party lines, with Democratic commissioners in favor and Republicans opposed. The telecommunications industry opposes the reintroduction of these federal rules and called them unnecessary government interference in their business decisions. Democrats have argued that the regulations are critical to consumer protection. Restoring net neutrality regulations has reignited a long-running battle over the open internet.
House Speaker Mike Johnson accuses students demonstrating for a ceasefire in Gaza of getting support from Hamas. TikTok says it will challenge the U.S. government's ban, and the Supreme Court dives into the gray area between abortion and pregnancy health care and into former President Trump's broad immunity claims. With more on these stories, it's Farah Siddiqui with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I'm one of many talented and promising students with bright futures who have been banned from campus. But Mike Johnson, who is an open racist and white supremacist, along with people like Gavin McGinnis, the head of the Proud Boys, they were welcomed on campus.
Sarah King, a Jewish Columbia University grad student suspended from school for protesting the war in Gaza, compares that to the treatment of Republicans and members of the far right. Hundreds of students were arrested at over a dozen protests across the U.S. and Canada this week. On social media, Speaker of the House Mike Johnson accused demonstrators of getting support from Hamas.
Johnson was heckled when visiting Columbia and calling for the National Guard to restore order.
I am committing today that the Congress will not be silent as Jewish students are expected to run for their lives and stay home from their classes hiding in fear.
Hearings on two huge cases show a deeply divided Supreme Court. Defending a near-total abortion ban Wednesday, lawyers for Idaho argued an exemption for the life of the mother is clear and broad enough to allow effective care. But Solicitor General Elizabeth Prelogar says the ban violates a federal law that hospitals have to give treatment in emergencies. She says it's often unclear when pregnancy complications become life-threatening.
Women in Idaho today are not getting treatment. They are getting airlifted out of the state to Salt Lake City and to neighboring states where there are health exceptions in their laws because the doctors are facing mandatory minimum 2 years in prison, loss of their license, criminal prosecution.
On Thursday, the court seemed unlikely to accept former President Donald Trump's position that he has near total criminal immunity. But citing the issue's possible impact on future presidents, some of the justices seemed willing to wrestle with the issue, which would likely stall one of Trump's more important criminal cases past the election. The repeal of Arizona's 1864 abortion ban now awaits approval of the state Senate and the governor. Yolanda Bejarano, chair of the Arizona Democratic Party, spoke after the successful repeal vote in the state House.
The contrast between our two parties could not be clearer. Democrats are fighting for abortion rights. We are fighting to protect Arizona values. And the Republican Party is taking away our rights and are under sole control of Donald Trump.
If the laws repealed, Arizona would go back to a 2022 15-week ban. TikTok says it'll challenge a law President Joe Biden signed forcing its Chinese parent company to divest from the U.S. or see the app blocked. TikTok CEO Xiaoji Chu addressing TikTok users in a video.
Make no mistake, this is a ban on TikTok and a ban on you and your voice.
Critics say the ban's a form of censorship fueled by anti-Chinese sentiment. Supporters say the app would allow Chinese surveillance. I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with an overnight low of 48, and tomorrow those clouds continue with a daytime high of 54 degrees. Today in history, in 1564, English playwright William Shakespeare is baptized in Stratford-upon-Avon in Warwickshire in England. His actual date of birth is unknown. The quote of the day is from Shakespeare's play Othello, quote, "Reputation is an idle and most false imposition, oft got without merit and lost without deserving."
The San Francisco social service organization Friendship House is helping the Yurok tribe restore justice off the reservation. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. In California, the Yurok tribe's justice system is providing a path for healing. Yurok tribal chief judge Abby Abenanti says they're also focusing on helping people off the reservation, other tribes, and the urban native population through their close connection with the social service organization, the Friendship House in San Francisco.
We need to work more with the urban population because many of our people went to the urban area and a lot of the relocated people have been in the urban area, and we need to team up. Our like value systems will help them and will help the communities they live in.
Friendship House founder, the late Helen Wakazoo, was a close friend of Judge Abby. Peter Bratt, Friendship House Village SF project lead, says Judge Abby and Helen were soul sisters.
And they were always plotting, and they always had these, you know, incredible dreams and visions. And one of them was to bring inpatient and outpatient recovery services to the remote northern part of the state where the Yurok Nation is. And so that vision is finally coming to fruition. And so Friendship House is working with the Yurok to build inpatient services up in Northern California that will serve not just the Yurok but the eight surrounding tribes. And then in turn, a lot of the clients who come to Friendship House are from the Yurok Nation.
Pratt says when a Native relative goes through recovery, they often leave the program and cannot return back to their tribal community. So they often stay in San Francisco for longer.
They live here, they get job training, they get work. And so we have many Yurok tribal members who are part of our staff and who live in and around the San Francisco Bay Area. The Yurok are also helping us to build housing for tribal members here in city and county.
Friendship House services include substance abuse treatment, a youth program, and recovery for women with children and expectant mothers. Those involved with the indigenous-led organization believe culture is medicine.
It centers traditional practices, ceremonial practices, as its treatment model. And again, going back to our founder, Helen Wakazu, she put a stake in the ground, you know, back in the early 80s and started bringing traditional people to work with our clients. And that was a very radical thing to do back then. But that essential cultural aspect of our program now, that has become a standard throughout Indian country.
Clayton Dumont is Friendship House Program Director.
In the last 3 months, we've actually brought in 9 different individual traditional practitioners to work with our clients. It's really important because it helps build trust with our clients. They're dealing with, you know, intergenerational trauma. In order for them to open up and address those issues, they need to trust us. We look at the healing process in terms of interconnected between the spiritual, the mental, the physical, and being able to address all those different things that comes out of our culture.
Pratt says the Friendship House is expanding with the Village Project, which will also be a cultural and spiritual hub.
That will offer medical, dental, behavioral health services. We're going to house our Women's Lodge program there, where young mothers, young American Indian mothers, can go through recovery with their small children. It's going to have a youth program, elder services, a rooftop farm.
And the Village is a vision Judge Abby shares. Construction has already begun on the Village SF project. This story is a collaboration with First Nations Experience Television with support from the Public Welfare Foundation. The Office of the Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs announced this week the opening of the Division of Indigenous Connectivity and Technology within the Bureau of Indian Affairs. The new division will assist tribes with managing and expanding new technological and wireless services on their lands. Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs Brian Newland says it will modernize the way tribal nations engage in these types of opportunities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
As construction progresses on Atlanta's Public Safety Training Center, a coalition of organizers, activists, and community members has emerged under the banner of Stop Cop City. Among them are disability justice activists who see the project as a direct threat to their community. Dom Kelly, with New Disabled South, highlights the lack of representation for marginalized communities in decision-making processes regarding Cop City's construction. He says this is not only a democracy issue, but will widen the gaps that already exist for disabled people encountering police.
We know that the state and federal prison population is 2/3 people with disabilities. And the argument that this will train police is not based in any factor data, because we know that implicit bias trainings don't actually improve police interaction.
The ATL Public Safety Training Center's website claims to train officers, firefighters, and civilian responders with modern methods focusing on harm reduction. However, Kelly believes this facility could contribute to police militarization and increased discrimination against people with disabilities. Kelly raises concerns about the facility's price tag. The project is estimated to cost $110 million, with the city contributing $31 million. Kelly argues that this money could be better used to improve outcomes for people with disabilities and marginalized communities.
They can do better to make sure that unhoused people who are living in poverty have access to resources, have access to housing. They can make sure they have food on their tables. Like, they could be helping ensure that our community is not being institutionalized.
Opposition to Cop City isn't just about policing and money. Kiana Jackson is the research and coalition organizing manager at NDS and says it's also a concern for the environment because of its location in the South River Forest.
Have people who are using taxpayer funds to destroy a forest. One of the main sources that we kind of naturally, you know, keep our environment clean. It says to those 7.6 million Georgians, it's more important for us to surveil you and police you than it is for us to keep you healthy.
Between its launch in June and September last year, Between its launch in June and September 11th of last year, the Cop City Vote campaign collected and submitted 116,000 signatures from Atlanta residents. Advocates say that this number is well over the threshold needed to get Cop City on the ballot. As the referendum petitions move through a contested verification process and direct action to stop Cop City's construction continues, disabled organizers say they're committed to continuing their work.
Washington State's ban on high-capacity magazines will remain in effect while a legal challenge makes its way through the courts. The law went into effect in July of 2022. It bans the sale of gun magazines with more than 10 rounds. One gun store owner, Gators Custom Guns, sold the magazines anyway until Attorney General Bob Ferguson sued them over it. A Cowlitz County judge ruled in the gun store's favor, saying that the law was unconstitutional and violated Second Amendment rights. The judge issued an injunction effectively overturning the ban. But 90 minutes later, another judge granted a temporary stay, undoing the overturning of the law, which means the ban was back in effect. In that time, Gator Guns took to social media, selling high-capacity magazines to about 250 people. High-capacity magazines are associated with around a 6% higher death toll in mass shooting events, according to a study in the American Journal of Public Health. The state Supreme Court commissioner, who allowed the ban to come back into effect, noted that it might not prevent a mass shooting, but it can improve people's chances of surviving one. The law will remain in effect through the appeals process. As for Oregon's gun control measure 1-14, the opposite is true. Enforcement will not begin until the legal process against the measure is sorted out. Earlier this month, a court agreed to expedite the state's appeal to a Harney County judge's decision that the voter-passed measure was unconstitutional. The measure requires a permit to buy a gun and bans the sale of high-capacity magazines like those in Washington.
An estimated 300,100 minors aged 13 to 17 in the U.S. identify as trans. A worrying report from UCLA's Williamson Institute at the School of Law discovered that an estimated 93% of these are living in states with anti-trans legislation. It would, and does, restrict their access to sports, school restrooms, and health care. 40 states have considered bans on gender-affirming care, and more than half of these succeeded in enacting them. Kareth Conran is the research director at the Williams Institute. She cited, quote, "a growing body of research showing that efforts to support transgender youth are associated with better mental health. Restrictions on medically appropriate care and full participation at school exacerbate the stress experienced by these youth and their families," end quote. 16 states have affirming care bans pending on top of the 24 already in motion.
A Clackamas County jury found the city of Lake Oswego was too restrictive in keeping people out of its lake. For years, access to Oswego Lake has been limited to property owners of homes surrounding the water, as well as a seasonal swim park that only city residents can use. The general public has not been allowed to enter Oswego Lake to swim, fish, or boat, but this could change soon. The case began in 2012 after kayaker Mark Kramer and open water swimmer Todd Prager filed a lawsuit challenging the city's rules about lake access. In 2022, a judge ruled that the waters are subject to Oregon's public trust doctrine that says the public must have access. The city's ordinances prohibit entering the lake from three city-owned properties, Headley Walkway, Sunleaf Plaza, and Millennium Park Plaza. The 2022 jury decided that there was no reasonable basis for restricting public entrance at Millennium Park Plaza, but certain restrictions in Sunleaf Plaza and Headley Walkway were reasonable. Clackamas County Circuit Judge Katie Steele will use the jury's verdict as a basis for a final written order expected sometime this May.
The airline industry has come under heavy public scrutiny over flight cancellation woes, refund issues, and mounting fees. But watchdogs say new federal rules announced this week could finally bring some relief to travelers. KBOO's Matea Carlin has more.
Air travelers could face fewer obstacles in securing a refund if their flight is canceled or changed under new federal rules announced Wednesday. The moves are being praised by watchdog groups. The Department of Transportation says airlines are now required to promptly provide passengers with automatic cash refunds when they're owed one. Teresa Murray, of the U.S. Public Interest Research Group, or PIRG, says some carriers haven't adhered to these standards, leaving passengers in a bind.
And they would drag their feet and they would say, oh, well, you bought your ticket from a ticket agent, and so we don't know where your money is, or here, have a voucher. And that was not acceptable.
But amid higher complaint volumes, companies will be forced to act quickly. The new rules, which are being phased in, provide clearer definitions for travel disruptions. That includes delays of at least 3 hours on a domestic flight and 6 hours on international flights. A key industry group responded to the announcement by touting transparency efforts among carriers. Murray says most people aren't frequent flyers, and it's hard for them to keep up on all the latest practices and policies among airlines.
The average person only flies once every 18 months. So this will just bring transparency to that process, and it kind of evens the playing field.
Murray says this could come in handy for Midwestern customers when a winter storm wreaks havoc on air travel. The new rules also require refunds for baggage fees when a piece of luggage is delayed by 12 hours or more for domestic flights. And there has to be upfront disclosure on fees for first and second checked bags and carry-on bags. For KBOO News and the Public News Service, I'm Matea Carlin.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, April 26, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Sam Bowman, Matea Carlin, and Ezra. The producer and engineer is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Alex Gonzalez, Farah Siddique, Shantaya Hudson, Mike Moen, and Antonio Gonzalez. The director of the Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website.